You're listening to Driving Law, a podcast by Kyla Lee about all things related to the rules of the road.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Driving Law. I am Kyla Lee at Acumen Law, and with me, my co-host, Paul Doroshenko.
Hi, Kyla.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I saw you this morning, and then I had to run. And here we are, you know, recording the podcast at a distance again.
Yep, yet again, at a distance, from a distance.
Exactly. And I thought the same thing when I said that. And I'm working out of our secret project today.
Great. Well,
so if you hear noise in the background, that's because there's always construction going on.
There was a not so secret project that went on in my life in the last week.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
So I was interviewed for the Who Cares series by the Women in Canadian Criminal Defense and featured on their Who Cares podcast talking about impaired driving.
Ah, fantastic. You know, Jay from our office did some research this week, and our podcast is number one law podcast in British Columbia.
Number one or number two?
Well, it's number one, but there's one that's from 9 years ago that still comes up first that nobody's added to that podcast since.
Yeah, so we're the number one law podcast in BC.
We're the only one that's actually an updated podcast.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations. And thank you so much to all the people who actually listen. I didn't realize we were that popular.
Well, I don't know that there's any other law podcast. Maybe we're like in a field of three or something.
Hey, whatever. Look, I'm happy our listeners are getting us there.
You know, I started another podcast and I quit after two. And this is the one that keeps me going.
Yeah. Well, that's because I insist that we keep it going.
Well, it's a good podcast, and I enjoy doing it. And a lot of people come up to me and tell me that they listen to it. A lot of police officers listen to it. I posted a TikTok just the other day explaining why traffic enforcement is a great job for the police. And I've had, I think, about 12,000 views of that TikTok. And it's interesting because a lot of police officers came out that, you know, aren't obviously police officers on TikTok, right? Came out to comment on it. And which was quite interesting. So we should probably promote the podcast on your TikTok or on my TikTok.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk about the Supreme Court of Canada rendering a decision in a driving law case this week.
Woohoo!
Yeah, well, don't woohoo too much just yet.
So, okay.
He's also called Boudreau, which is interesting, because we had the Boudreau case from the Supreme Court of Canada not that long ago, which was also a driving law case. So we've got, you know, multiple driving law related Boudreaus at the Supreme Court of Canada to just make things more complex. But this case involves a conviction for dangerous operation of a motor vehicle that came out of Quebec. And so what had happened was Mr. Boudreau, he was convicted of dangerous driving causing bodily harm. His vehicle and the complainant's vehicle were driving down the highway in 2017. And he rear-ends the complainant's vehicle, and they suffer a cervical dorsal sprain, which continued to persist symptoms-wise at trial 4 years later. So serious injuries, long-lasting, lifelong injuries. There were multiple witnesses who said that he had been driving erratically before the collision. Three witnesses, plus a video from a transport camera, a Department of Transport camera, that showed him driving before the collision. And it showed his vehicle climbing a hill, and then it goes out of the range of the camera. The collision can't be seen on the video. And the judge, you know, says, okay, we can't really give much weight to the evidence in the camera because it doesn't depict the collision. So we don't really know how that relates to any sort of allegation of dangerous driving in the circumstances of the case. But the court did find that Mr. Boudreau was driving dangerously on the basis of the witnesses, and that specifically the complainant had pulled quickly into the left lane. Mr. Boudreau said that the complainant pulled quickly into the left lane in front of him, that he was speeding up to pass slow moving traffic in the right lane. She rejects this because the damage to the vehicles is inconsistent with his version of events. There was damage not just to the rear corner of the vehicle, but the entire rear structure. And she said, you know, if the complainant had moved into the left lane, then the damage would have been on the left side of the vehicle, not the rear. And so he was convicted on the basis of this. So it ultimately is an appeal based on a finding of credibility and a judge's determination of the facts.
Okay. Factual-based issue.
Yes.
And so how did this end up? How does a factual-based issue like that end up at the Supreme Court of Canada?
It was an appeal as of right. So he had a dissenting judge on the appeal. So he got a right of appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada automatically. But as I think you probably know, given your knowledge of how fact-based appeals tend to go, it didn't go well. Mr. Boudreau at the Supreme Court of Canada.
Nope.
So he argued.
Yeah. The Supreme Court of Canada, those judges don't drive, they have drivers. They no longer remember what it's like to deal with a dynamic situation on the road.
Yeah. Anyway, he argued on appeal that the trial judge had made errors assessing the evidence and that basically, you know, there was a misapprehension of material evidence that should lead to a new trial. The Court of Appeal, one judge dissenting, dismissed his appeal. And the dissenting judge basically said that the trial judge made two errors. First, in rejecting his testimony on the basis of this illogical inference about where the damage would be, and that his version of events was completely consistent with the location of the damage. And secondly, the second error that the dissenting judge found was that the trial judge's finding that the complainant had been driving in the left lane well before the impact was actually contradicted or inconsistent with the testimony of the complainant herself, who says that she had moved into the left lane because of congestion in the right lane. So, you know, there is some suggestion that that maybe there was an argument that he could have made that, you know, the evidence wasn't properly apprehended. But the Supreme Court of Canada dismissed it and didn't just dismiss the appeal, but dismissed it from the bench in a unanimous one paragraph judgment.
Yeah.
And
facts upon it.
Now, I find that interesting because this iteration of the Supreme Court of Canada under Chief Justice Wagner, it has not been known for its unanimous judgments.
No, that's true. But like, look at the way that they view driving cases. You know, it's perpetually deferring to the finder of fact. It's if anything moving toward a, you can get convicted for anything. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So
off
just
the bench, off the bench is just telling you how they feel. They don't even have to argue about it. They've already decided beforehand. Maybe they go into the back for 5 minutes after submissions, come back out and say, yeah, we agree with the majority at the Court of Appeal.
Yeah. So Justice Côté delivers the reasons for the bench, and it was a French trial, but they posted a translated version of the judgment on the Supreme Court of Canada's website. And basically what they say is, having examined the trial judge's reasons delivered orally to determine whether the verdict was vitiated by illogical or irrational reasoning within the meaning of Beaudry and Sinclair, we would dismiss the appeal with respect. Even though the judge could have expressed herself more clearly at times, the appellant has not shown a reviewable error because the judge's inference was based on the whole of the evidence. In particular, there is no reviewable error in relation to the complainant's testimony about the position of her car at the time of the collision. As a result, and substantially for the reasons of the majority of the Court of Appeal, we unanimously dismiss the appeal. So they're basically like, yeah, it doesn't even matter that the complainant, there was an error with what the complainant said, because it wasn't a reviewable error.
Slag the judge a little bit, just a little bit. Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, judge, but nope. So not great. And we continue to see this trend in the law of dangerous driving essentially being any bad driving, which is not encouraging.
No, and it makes you really frightened to be a driver.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the types of things that we see, like, charged for dangerous driving, the types of things that we see that are dangerous driving related convictions, I would say even in the, 13 years that I've been practicing now, there's been a massive shift in the landscape.
Yeah, huge. And again, it's one of those things, like, you wonder how the people who are making these decisions, judges, come to the conclusion. You sort of think that they're too far separated from the society to understand, not driving. They don't remember having to be a person who's on the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we see where people are charged with driving-related offenses, dangerous driving offenses, in circumstances where they're taking all the reasonable precautions you could expect a person to take and make
a judgment call that just doesn't work, or a small mistake that is just a moment of inattention or paying attention to the wrong thing for a second.
What?
Yep. Anywho, that's not encouraging.
Not an encouraging thing, but that's what we have.
Yep.
Now, we also have situations, though, where police officers engage in bad driving and somehow don't end up facing the same charges that non-police officers face. And there's a couple
somehow.
We've seen, for example, the case involving the police officer in the downtown East Side who ran over the homeless guy while speeding.
Yep.
And in that case, the police officer was charged with driving without care. So we've had a couple high-profile incidents lately that have attracted attention. There was the case of the police officer in the downtown East Side who was speeding, who ran over an unhoused person and was not charged with dangerous driving, but was only charged with driving without due care and attention. There was also the case in Toronto where the Toronto police literally ran over a lady in a crosswalk, and then they didn't even charge with anything. And they said, well, we didn't really hit her. And they drove off. They didn't even stop and exchange information or see if she was okay. With nothing.
Yeah.
Investigate. Yeah. So you see police officers sort of facing these charges, but being subjected to different standards. And I think that speaks to sort of the problem with the fluidity of the definition of dangerous driving in our criminal system.
Yeah, it really undermines confidence when you see that. You know, I'm perpetually saying that you can have confidence in the justice system, that the police are subject to the same scrutiny. And I just feel like it's a legal fiction that I'm perpetuating a lie. And I don't feel good about it because it's become quite obvious. You know, I could think of many cases in the past where the police were subject to the same level of scrutiny and police officers charged in circumstances where, you'd be thinking, well, they really were in the course of their duty doing something very reasonable. But it seems to have been a pendulum swing. And it just really feels like if you're part of the club now, you're protected. And that doesn't inspire confidence with anybody.
No, it doesn't. But there's a recent incident that has happened involving the police in Langley. So this is a man who was in a Langley traffic stop. And the civilian watchdog, the Independent Investigations Office, has had to step in because a person was involved in a crash with police following an attempted traffic stop on Monday of this week and has now died from their injuries. And the allegation that the police are making is that the officer was attempting to stop a car. It was traveling east on 16th Avenue in Langley. The driver didn't pull over. They pursued the vehicle. And at 16th and 264 Street, the driver of the vehicle was involved in a crash. And it was the passenger in the vehicle who died as a result of the injuries. The other vehicle that was involved in the crash, the innocent vehicle, so to speak, there was nobody injured there. And the female driver, the one who was allegedly fleeing from police, got minor injuries. So that's pretty serious. I mean, some sort of an incident involving police where the police watchdog has stepped in and where charges maybe are going to be brought. But no clear indication whether this is going to be pursued as dangerous operation, even though there's a death.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see if the double standard applies.
Yeah.
I'm not optimistic.
No, I'm not either, unfortunately. But at least there is, civilian oversight on this one, whereas on the others, there didn't really seem to be. And it was, police investigating police and making those determinations.
Yeah. I always have to defend, because it's my job, defend the structures that exist. And so I do so again. I have confidence in their capacity to investigate. We'll see whether or not my confidence is well placed.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk very briefly about this incident that has been making the rounds in Canadian news, a very Canadian incident, and some of the implications of this. So this is minor or junior hockey. There's a player named Jordan Dumais, and he has been charged in Quebec, I believe, with impaired driving. Oh, no, Halifax. He's charged in Halifax with impaired driving. He's facing criminal charges, and as a result of the charge, just the unproven allegation for this individual, he has been suspended from his junior league hockey for 5 games.
Yeah, that's completely wrong. I mean, innocent until proven guilty, it's a criminal charge. I understand that the concern is that they always hold it out as that, these are role models and so forth, which is kind of rubbish.
Innocent people are charged with impaired driving all the time.
Well, more innocent people are charged with impaired driving than any other offense. More people are acquitted or exonerated or cleared of an impaired driving offense than any other offense. Any other offense, as a specific offense, right? Which is why I don't like to see any of this. Anybody who's basing this punishment before the fact, especially in circumstances where that lots of hockey players have made this mistake, it's hardly the end of the world. And once again, every police officer always assumes that anybody who's ever pulled over for impaired driving is an alcoholic, and alcoholism's a disease. So where's the fairness here?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And, a 5-game suspension is the type of thing that, in hockey you generally see for completely discreditable conduct, not an unproven allegation. And I can understand, in the administrative sphere of sports rules being applied, that maybe some sort of an action is warranted when a person violates their morality clause by picking up a charge. But a 5-game suspension, and then, Lord knows what's going to happen to this poor kid if he ends up convicted.
Yeah, it's over the top as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry for him. I wish that they had approached this differently from the employment law context. I think that would be, he'd have a great argument to compel them to to lift that from the hockey contract law. I guess it all really comes down to what's in his contract. It might be in his contract that, you know, if you are charged with something like this, the charge alone is enough to suspend you.
Yep.
Going to come down to what's in his contract. I assume you're not paid when you're suspended for a game, right?
No.
I assume there's, yeah. You're probably paid a salary, but you're probably also played per game. And I don't know if you get it either in those circumstances. You know, I think starting a fight on the ice is more discreditable than an allegation of something, in my mind.
Yeah, I agree.
You and I are the converted. I don't know what the listeners would feel. I mean, I know a lot of police officers just assume as soon as somebody's been alleged to be impaired that they're guilty. So, and don't like the fact that people are acquitted of impaired driving ever.
Well, that brings us, Paul, speaking of all these depressing things and shenanigans and over-the-top reactions, to the McGracken moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, let loose the law and justice, Kraken! Eric McGracken!
Welcome to the McGracken moment. ICBC being dishonorable. That's the theme of this week's moment. So here's the context. Under our tort system, back when people had rights for car crashes, when you sue for damages and were awarded damages, ICBC could deduct from the award they have to pay you anything you can get from your own policy of insurance. Those were called your Part 7 benefits. And so a case called Taylor and Peters, ICBC brought an application for a deduction. The plaintiff was badly injured in a crash. She was not at fault. Her case went to trial and she was awarded $407,000. ICBC said a whole lot of that money is something she can get from ICBC directly under the Part 7 benefits. And they asked the court to reduce the judgment by about $141,000. But the plaintiff said, hold on, I've been fighting with you guys for years, and I've needed these benefits for years, and you guys have not honored my contract of insurance. You haven't paid what you're supposed to pay. Now, ICBC came to the court promising they're going to do better. They said, hey, we didn't pay everything we should have. They basically fell on their sword, but said, moving forward, we promise we will. While Madam Justice Lurie had no time for those empty promises, the court found that ICBC's past actions and their years of mistreatment of the plaintiff's claim spoke better than their promise to the court about how they were likely going to treat her in the future. And so the court said, I am unable to presume that ICBC will conduct itself honorably moving forward. The court went on to find that ICBC basically ignores requests for Part 7 benefits on a serial basis and would always let it escalate to the point of a lawyer needing to get involved and litigation being threatened before they did their job. So, folks, if you're not having your Part 7 benefits paid in a timely fashion, you're not alone, but Madam Justice Murray did a great job calling ICBC's behavior out and spoke some harsh words to them and gave a good precedent for the rest of us.
Eric does not make us feel any better about the situation involving ICBC and your rights when dealing with ICBC. Most depressing.
No, it's a perpetual bad news story there, right? The only time that we ever have a good news story with ICBC is when the court sort of fences them in a little bit.
Yeah.
People have the hate on for ICBC. And once again, this is one of those things that I spent so much time defending ICBC. And, you know, my defense of ICBC has been, look how things play out in different provinces. You don't know when it's individual insurance companies, how badly they've screwed people over. And I've had to deal with those private insurance companies in Alberta, and they're awful. But ICBC is not doing itself any favors.
Yeah, they're not. But as I was saying, I think this is a depressing podcast today. And I would like to lighten the mood a little bit.
Please do.
So it's time for
the Ridiculous Driver of the Week.
A surprising bestseller? The Pinpoint Method of cross-examination is catching on. Law firms and new litigators across Canada have caught on to cross-examination, the Pinpoint Method. Kyla Lee's straightforward handbook that teaches you effective cross-examination skills.
And this week, we have somebody who it's probably going to be hard to defend this person, assuming the information that the police are providing is accurate, because this is a driver who was caught in Toronto on the highway traveling at 264 kilometers per hour.
Wow. 264. Yeah. Most German cars are like speed limited to 240.
Yeah.
So what the hell is he driving? Like one of those Nissan...
I think it's a BMW. They posted a photo. The OPP posted a photo of like the speed gun with the 264 kilometer an hour reading. And you can see a white sedan. It looks BMW-ish.
Wow.
You might identify the car. You know these things.
Well, I'll have to look. The 264. That's full on aircraft speed. I'm assuming that person's being charged with dangerous driving, because that sure as fuck is dangerous driving.
No, they're actually just facing a provincial charge of stunt driving. And then under Ontario's law, if you get charged with stunt driving, you get an automatic 30-day license suspension and your vehicle gets impounded for 14 days. So that's
administrative right off the top.
Long
before any conviction.
Correct.
But you're not counting on him being acquitted in any event.
Well, I mean, as soon as you're going that speed, it's, you know, it doesn't really matter whether they can prove you were going 264, because what they can prove is you were going really fucking fast.
Yep.
Like, I actually had this conversation with a judicial justice in traffic court once where, my client was charged with excessive speed. They were alleged to have been going extremely fast. And the rationale for the conviction was it didn't really matter if the evidence of the officer was successfully challenged on the specific speed that they measured, because by the time you get to more than 40 kilometers an hour over the speed limit, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that a person is speeding.
Yeah, I know. There's only so much you can do sometimes. There's lots of times that you can shake a police officer's evidence about things, but there's sometimes, you know, it's just like he was going 39 kilometers an hour over the speed limit. I made the speed estimate. I used my device. That's what it was. Ooh, you think you could be wrong in the margin there, maybe? Plus or minus 5%? No. Well, that's the fastest ridiculous driver I think we've ever had.
Yeah, that is. I that might be the fastest driver I've seen a story about. So we're gonna keep an eye on if anyone can break the record. But my legal advice to you in closing on this podcast, dear listeners, is do not try to break that record unless you are on the Autobahn or in a closed track.
Well, in the Autobahn, again, I mean, it's German cars and they're limited to 240. But I have been passed by cars going faster than that on the Autobahn, usually Jaguars.
Yeah. Well,
that's what I remember.
That's our podcast. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Driving Law. If you need to reach us about a driving law related incident, you can give us a call at 604-688-8889, or you can find us online at vancouvercriminallaw.com. And tune in next week for another exciting episode of Driving Law.